Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Whiskey Rebellion. I'm here with Frank, or I'm actually not here with Frank. I'm here and still in Edinburgh. And Frank, where are you this week?
Good morning, everybody. I'm in Washington, D.C., David.
Okay. And how are things in D.C. looking? You're bright there early in the morning. It's early afternoon here in Scotland.
Yeah, it's cold and sunny here. I went out for a walk last night soon after I arrived, and there was a dancing protest outside of the new Trump Hotel.
That's amazing.
On Pennsylvania Avenue. They were playing some really, really nice music, and I hung out there for a little while on my way to dinner.
That sounds lovely. So we were talking earlier about trying to come up with topics for today's episodes, and we're sort of having an embarrassment of riches of history and in contemporary life and politics this week. So we had a hell of a time sort of culling the list down to something manageable. The list we settled on for our topic one is we're going to look at civil servants and how they fit in and how they descend within the context of government, thinking about Trump's firing of the interim attorney general. Our second topic, also in some ways inspired by the president's remarks this week, is looking at Black History Month. And the third topic, inspired in part by the AHA's statement on Trump's immigration policy, we're going to look at historians as activists. What role do historians have in the political sphere? So Frank, the president, I guess at the beginning of the week, fired the interim attorney general after she dissented on his immigration policy. This isn't, I guess, the first time that a president has sacked an attorney general.
No. I mean, I think the reason, you know, in our own discussions, we wanted to focus on this, David, is because it seems that the president has difficulty understanding the separation of powers. I mean, he began the week by firing Sally Yates, the interim attorney general, excuse me, and he finished it by questioning the authority of a federal judge who seems to have called into question his executive order, calling him a so-called judge. So yeah. I think this will be a theme of Trump's presidency. But as you say, this is not unprecedented. I mean, the analogy that was made on Monday was the Saturday Night Massacre of Richard Nixon, when Richard Nixon fired the Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, after instructing Richardson to fire the Watergate special prosecutor Archibald Cox. Richardson refused to do that, and Nixon sacked him, as well as the Deputy Attorney General, William Ruckelshaus, and he eventually found Robert Bork, who would achieve fame later, or infamy later in the 1980s as a Supreme Court candidate, to do the job. And so that was a kind of analogy that people, historians and pundits, made immediately. Some went further back to Andrew Jackson, because Jackson fired a number of his Treasury secretaries.
Carries, to be sure.
Trying to wage war on the Bank of the United States, the second Bank of the United States. It's interesting, the two most common themes that seem to come up in terms of the analogies that seem to come up most frequently in terms of people looking for comparisons to President Trump seem to be Nixon and Andrew Jackson. Neither of those augurs particularly well, actually.
Well, the one that strikes me is actually most similar to that in terms of the Yates firing, because Yates, of course, is a carryover from the Obama administration, is Andrew Johnson's firing of Edwin Stanton,
right?
The one that prompted his impeachment, because in that case, Stanton was one of the one, I think, one or two remaining cabinet carryovers that had stayed on since the Lincoln administration. And, you know, Congress had put in legislation to specifically prohibit his firing in the Tenure of Office Act. And so in some ways, I think that might be the sort of best historical analogy for what President Trump has done, where he's firing not somebody that he appointed, but firing somebody that was actually appointed by a previous administration.
I think that's an excellent analogy, David. The reason I think this is important is not just because of the question of executive authority and separation of powers, but because I think it's going to be an ongoing theme. So in midweek, Sally Yates put a face to this, if you will. But in midweek, Sean Spicer came out in his press briefing and basically attacked the approximately 1,000 Foreign Service officers who signed a letter of dissent concerning, again, the executive order on immigration. And the dissent channel within the State Department was created during the Vietnam War, well, for a very good reason, to allow Foreign Service officers and diplomats of the United States to register dissent from American policy. And this dissent channel is actually quite important in a number of ways. In response to such letters of dissent or petitions, the Secretary of State is required to respond to such letters, and never have 1,000 Foreign Service officers signed such a letter before, nor the normal number for such a letter of dissent would be 50. So this is a very, very significant protest, if you will, or expression of dissent. And Spicer's response was to say, look, get with the program or get out. Well, there's a practical problem here, which I think the Trump administration has not recognized, which is you can't just fire 1,000 Foreign Service officers and replace them easily or ask for their resignations. And there's the larger issue here, represented by Sally Yates, represented by these Foreign Service officers, that or a question that's raised about the responsibility of civil servants to dissent when they disagree with the policies of their government. Don't know whether you have any views on that.
Well, so I mean, in some ways, this is a problem that, or a crisis that is really one that is really most prevalent, I think, in the 20th century than it is in the 19th century, which I study, in the 18th century, which you look at, in large part because, when we're looking at changes of administration in the 19th century, for most of it, you go in, you fire everybody that the previous administration had in office, all the way down to postmasters, and replace them with your guys. The spoils system, this sort of system in which the winning party was able to make appointments based on political loyalty rather than based on expertise. That was a prevalent and accepted part of politics, and it wasn't so much ideologically based. It was really much sort of about party loyalty and getting out the vote and all the kinds of political corruption that we had in the 19th century. And you start to see that ending in the sort of new system of professional civil servants developing, actually after the Garfield assassination, of all things. When Charles Jouteau killed Garfield, he did it in part because he thought he deserved a plum ambassadorship and didn't get it. And then they passed the Pendleton Act in response to that to actually have some qualifications for civil servants. And now I think that sort of system, we have a huge number of people, most of the people who work for these agencies, whether it's the State Department, whether it's the Park Service, most of the federal government is hired based on their qualifications and experience, and so and stay in office regardless of who's in the White House. And it's only the sort of the management level that gets replaced with new administrations. But it is a tremendous amount of expertise, if Trump really is interested in getting rid of all these people, that would be lost.
Yeah, we've got a bit of a hybrid system in the US, I think. You're right. In the 20th century, the civil service became increasingly professionalized. But there are vestiges of the old spoils system. And you see this in the appointment of ambassadors, for example. Whereas in the UK, where we both now live, the civil service has been separate from kind of the politicians for much, much longer. And the civil servants are seen as a kind of permanent fixture, and they are a separate, if you will, almost professional class. The politicians and government ministers come and go, but the civil servants are constant. We
People
have a
actually know how to
lot.
do things.
Yeah, indeed. Which is quite important as far as retaining institutional memory. And we're seeing, I think, some tension in the early days of the Trump administration because of their desire to kind of embrace chaos and creative chaos at some level. I think that it's potentially going to cause a great deal of difficulties as far as how government services and government are delivered and how government operates. But it does also call into or throws into it throws a light onto the whole question of what the responsibility of civil servants is, the political responsibility. We saw this with the alternative national park sites, which are absolutely wonderful on Twitter, where they said, okay, you can take down our official Twitter feeds, but you don't control what we do at night. We are citizens of a republic and we have opinions.
Yeah.
And so there's always been, a tension between the responsibilities of the citizen and the responsibility of the servant of the state.
And the extent to which, you know, the federal government can try to muzzle these people. I mean, I think legally, you know, if there were to be retribution against the alternative National Park Service, you know, Twitter feeds, I think that would actually be in violation of federal law. But I'm not sure that that matters if you've already lost your job and have to fight to get it back.
Indeed. And I don't, you know, this Godwin's law, you should never bring up the Nazis. It ends in debate, and I'm not making that analogy except insofar as to say, of course, the principle laid down at Nuremberg in the Nuremberg trials, which is an important principle in international laws, you can't say you were just following orders. So civil servants are required to follow their consciences, and that's certainly what those Foreign Service officers did when they legally signed this letter of dissent, and there's a dissent channel which exists to allow them to do so. Or attorney, temporary Attorney General Yates was, in her view, doing her job, which was enforcing the law, or in her case, refusing to enforce an edict that she felt was illegal.
Yeah, I mean, they do take, it's not only their conscience, but their oath is to uphold the Constitution, regardless of there's the clip that was going around on Facebook and on Twitter and other places where during Yates's confirmation hearing, when she was appointed to the position, her position in the Justice Department, where she was asked, if the president gives you an order you think is unconstitutional, will you stand up to him? And this, of course, was when she was appointed under President Obama, and she gave what is the right answer to that question, which is, of course, I would stand up to the president if, the president gave an order that was, unconstitutional, that my obligation is first to the Constitution and to the people of the United States, not to the president. There is a slight irony to that, in as much as the person who was asking the question asked her this question, challenging her about whether or not she would reject the president's demands if the president was asking an unconstitutional question, was a member of the Judiciary Committee, Jeff Sessions, who is now, of course, Trump's nominee to be attorney general. So we'll see how that plays out. Trump does seem to want to surround himself by people who are particularly loyal to him rather than people who will, dissent from his worldview.
That's right. And in that, again, the analogy might be Richard Nixon, although it didn't end very attitude resulted in an administration that didn't end well for anyone involved in it, either President Nixon or those who were loyal to him.
Yeah. I mean, we can think of, historically different presidents have addressed this in different ways in terms of surrounding themselves with people who are either yes men of various kinds or people who are more likely to dissent. And I think we can say with some confidence that people who have been most successful in that office have been people who have surrounded themselves, people who are more willing to challenge them and challenge the wisdom of their decisions rather than people who are willing to go along with whatever the president wants to do.
Yeah, that's right. Right.
Well, all right,
go ahead.
So our second topic is to look at after Black History Month. Frank, did you get a chance to watch the president's comments about the start of African American History Month a couple days ago?
I did, David. And as you'll know, that engendered quite a bit of traffic on Twitter, which is one of the things he really enjoys doing. He made a statement, and look, presidents. Every month is something month, and presidents come out and make statements all the time about these. They're normally prepared in advance by their aides, And all he really had to do was read this statement. However, he gave the impression that he either had never heard of the great African-American abolitionist and civil rights activist Frederick Douglass, or that he thought that Frederick Douglass is still alive. And this, as I said, engendered a great deal of traffic and mockery on social media.
Yes.
But it underscored, if you will, it brought more attention to a presidential statement at the beginning of Black History Month than most of these things do.
Yeah, yes.
So, David, could you say a little bit about the kind of origins and history of Black History Month?
Sure. So Black History Month in the United States actually began as Black History Week. It was started, or actually at the time I think it was called Negro History Week, in the 1920s. And it was started by historian Carter Woodson, who was one of the more prominent African, probably the most prominent African American historian of his generation. And he, you know, was trying to, you know, the American curriculum, both in white schools and in Black schools, of course, this is at the height of segregation, was primarily almost exclusively, you know, about white history and about who was president and generals and whatnot, that African-American history was not in the textbooks. It wasn't, you know, in the curriculum in any meaningful way. And so part of his idea behind creating a Negro History Week was to create a venue, a time and a place to specifically focus on the contributions of African-Americans. And they decided to have it in February because that was the birthday of both Abraham Lincoln on the 12th, and the day that Frederick Douglass's birthday is celebrated on the 14th. Douglass actually didn't know what his birthday was, but he celebrated it on the 14th. And so that's why it was in February, and it began really as an educational mission, and it starts off as a week, and it gets transitioned into a month in the 1970s, actually during the bicentennial, where it's status is elevated to all of February. One thing I was surprised about, actually, when I moved to the UK, we actually have a different Black History Month than the US. I guess I got here in August and was asked, you know, in September what I was doing for Black History Month. And I was thinking that's planning pretty far in advance. But actually in the UK, they have Black History Month in October. They have a sort of separate origin story for Black History Month in the UK. Supposedly it was founded, I believe, in the 1980s. And the origin story for it is it was founded by British African scholar. And he picked October because that was a time of holiday and celebration in Africa. At least that was the story he told about why he picked that particular month for Black History Month. So we've got two Black History Months on a transatlantic basis, one in February in the United States and in October here in the UK.
Well, that's interesting, David. There's a little bit of a backlash against Black History Month. There's an argument that some critics have made, say, why do we need Black History Month? We shouldn't, you know, aren't we just separating and segregating, if you will, Black history if we have a separate month for it and privileging it for one month? Isn't that a problem? And this critique comes from both the left and the right. There are those on the left who say, you know, every month is Black History Month, and those on the right who say we don't need this, and Black History Month is an implicit criticism of the United States, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think of that, particularly as somebody who works on the Civil War?
Yeah, so I mean, there have been criticisms, as you point out, both on the right and the left about Black History Month and how relevant it still is. You know, I think Morgan Freeman has come out saying he doesn't think we should have a Black History Month. He says we don't have a White History Month, so why should we have a Black History Month? And there's some, you know, merit to that argument. I would say, like in my own research and teaching, you know, every month is Black History Month in a sense. I'm always, you know, reading Black sources and engaging with Black history on some level. But I think having a specific time in the year where we make specific cognizance of a Black history, I think is still important, especially when we're going, you know, beyond the academy, you know, into schools and then outside of schools, you know, trying to communicate to a general public, having a specific time where we focus on the contributions of African Americans in particular, I think has real value. Even if, you know, the curriculum that, that Carter Woodson is looking at, looked at, and the reason why he needed a Negro History Week in the first place, I think, you know, obviously the curriculum isn't the same 100 years later. We've all integrated African American history into everything that we do, much in the same way we've integrated women's history into everything that we do. We've indicated labor history into everything that we do. But I think there's still a place and a purpose for Black History Month, especially in a public history context.
I agree with you. I mean, I think there's a kind of paradox at the heart of this. Arguably, the literature on historiography, the historiography on race and slavery in the United States has been the richest field in American historiography for probably the last three generations, at least the last two, but probably the last three.
I would agree.
American historians and American historiography has made its most profound contributions. So this is the richest area of historical research we have, I think, and it's fabulous. But the kind of contemporary public debates, such as they are, public discourse on race and the history of slavery in particular, and enslaved peoples, suggest that we're not necessarily reaching a wider audience or as wide an audience as we might like, as evidenced, frankly, by President Trump's rather half-fisted comments to begin Black History Month. And so I think there's a lot of work to do, and we need to do more to communicate the richness of that literature to a wider audience, and it serves that purpose.
Yeah, I think both he and Spicer need to spend more time actually reading Black history than they clearly have during the past 70 Black History Months that we've had during Trump's lifetime, because clearly didn't get the memo or the message or the meaning of the whole thing, if his statement at that breakfast is any indication of his understanding of African-American history more broadly.
Yeah, I mean, I was pleased to see one thing, which is I saw a tweet from the Library of America, which, for those who are unfamiliar with it, is just an amazing publishing enterprise. And they've had a surge in orders in the past few days for their volume of Frederick Douglass's writings and speeches. So if more people may actually ask themselves, who is Frederick Douglass?
There are backdoor benefits to all of these things if we look hard enough, I guess. All right, our third topic is looking at in some ways it's kind of connected to Black History Month in a way. It's about historians as activists, and we were thinking about this in light of the American Historical Association's comment on Trump's immigration policy, where the AHA issued a fairly lengthy statement critiquing Trump's immigrant and refugee ban, and it was a statement that went on to be endorsed by a number of organizations, including, this is breaking news, this is, as nobody else knows, it's not actually going to be officially announced until tomorrow. Among the organizations that has now endorsed the AHA statement is the Scottish Association for the Study of America, which made its executive decision approximately an hour and a half ago to endorse the AHA statement. So it's now an international amalgamation of historical organizations that have endorsed it. Frank, does your memory on these things may be longer than mine is. Does the AHA usually intervene on political questions like this very often, or is this something that's kind of unprecedented?
To my memory, not that often. But actually, David, before we address that, I want to frame this in a slightly different way, if it's okay with you.
Sure.
Because I want to put you on the spot.
Oh, good.
On social media earlier this week on Twitter and Facebook, and we encourage you all to follow us on Twitter.
Yes.
And Facebook. You made a statement saying there's never been a more important time to be an historian. What did you mean by that? Because I think this relates to this question of social historians as activists.
Well, I meant that in multiple senses. One is, I think being a historian gives you sort of certain kinds of intellectual tools to process some of the stuff that's going on right now about evaluating evidence, about evaluating claims that people are making, about trying to sort of look at the ways in which political structures are working or not working. But I think even sort of on a second level, I think we as historians have an obligation, or at least I feel an obligation. I guess I can't speak for everybody, but I feel an obligation to when Trump or Trump's administration or other politicians engage in an activity that is clearly, has historical resonance, either in American history, or, and I have colleagues who do obviously history of other parts of the world, have resonances there, that we have an obligation to talk about those resonances and engage meaningfully in the political process. So when, Trump criticizes, as we've been talking about, criticize a judge who put a hold on his order or fired his attorney general or whatever it is he's doing, we have an obligation to respond to that using our expertise as historians and engage in the political process in a meaningful way, to recognize that there are precedents for some of these things, and a lot of those precedents are things that are in retrospect deeply troubling, whether it's precedents that sort of connect his immigration ban to things like Japanese American internment, or whether it's precedents about firing attorney generals like Nixon did, and the ways in which we need to speak out. We can't stay in the ivory proverbial ivory tower, where we only sort of speak to each other and speak to our students and write our books that nobody reads, and all that kind of stuff. We need to actually engage in the public. And I guess in some ways the podcast that we've been doing now for 3 weeks is part of that. I feel an obligation not just to speak to other historians, but try to speak beyond that to people who are trying to make sense of the world that's changing very quickly around us. And I'm obviously in that camp too, where I'm trying to make sense of how the world is changing, how America is changing. But I think I have a particular skill set that I should share with the public in a way.
Well, I think that's what the AAJ was making, just such a statement. Can you think of any examples in terms of some of the commentary on it? I think they've echoed and endorsed the views you just stated, but can you think of any historical examples, if you will, of other historians as activists?
One thing I think about generally, I think we should say before we get to those examples of people as activists, is that, to a large degree, American higher education over the past 300 years, hasn't probably been as politically involved as it could have been. I think the general story is one of academics not being somewhat divorced, if you will, from specific political engagement. And it's only been sort of the exceptional case historically where people have gotten actively involved. I think there's a lot of examples from the civil rights movement. You could look at things like, I guess, C. Van Woodward's Strange Career of Jim Crow as a both somebody that's a scholarly intervention, but also a kind of political intervention with segregation.
Right. And before that, even W.E.B. Du Bois.
Sure.
Was a kind of historian as activist, very much an activist. Yes. And a historian.
Yeah. I think African-American historians and African-American intellectuals, have always played that role. It's hard not to be, in some ways, being a black intellectual by its very nature for most of the 20th century has been a political act in and of itself. But the civil rights movement, I think, really gave lots of historians sort of a venue for political activity that had not been present, say, in the 19th century. You don't find academics getting involved very much in politics there. There's really only a very small handful of examples of individuals, nevertheless organizations, making meaningful political statements. But I think a lot of historians are hesitant to speak publicly about politics, in part because I think there's a deep fear, at least there has been, about being attacked for getting politically involved. You know, especially for people who teach at state universities. We can think about, Trump, trying to escape the present, but I can't. Trump recently attacked Berkeley, when Berkeley canceled a speech given by a alt-right speaker. Milo's speech got canceled because of threats of violence and actual violence going on in Berkeley. And Trump, attacked them and said that, he threatened to pull federal funds from Berkeley, which I don't think he can do, but he might try. I think there's a fear of stepping outside of our particular training to engage in politics because of the opportunity for retribution. Thinking back a few years, another example that comes to mind is Bill Cronin at the University of Wisconsin. And Cronin, of course, is a very important scholar on environmental history, a historian who's written a number of award-winning books, a very prominent individual within the profession. And he got involved, Wisconsin, of course, several years ago, went from being a fairly blue state to being a fairly red state. And Cronin started a blog where he was critiquing some of the legislation that was going through Wisconsin, some of the restrictions on labor organization and other things. And so, somebody who is stepping out into the public sphere. And the response of actually one particular Republican legislator was to put a Freedom of Information request in to read all of Cronin's emails, or a lot of Cronin's emails, to see if he was engaging in political activity on his university email account. And luckily for Cronin, he had separate email accounts for his political activity and his correspondence with students and stuff. But
he'd never get elected president.
Yeah, he's got his own server. But in this case, having his own server, or at least his own Gmail account, saved him his job. But I think it's that kind of silencing of academics that I think keeps a lot of people, or often traditionally has kept people from speaking out publicly. We can think of, there was a case at Duke University around the turn of the century, about 100 years ago, where one of the professors there spoke out against segregation. He got basically run out of the university by critics. There was a UNC professor in the 1850s, I think, who voiced some sympathy for Republicans, and he basically got run out of the state. I think academics by nature tend to be fairly cautious and somewhat risk averse. And I think some of these particular examples indicate that things don't always work out so well for them when they do sort of step out of the bounds of the particular, safety of the ivory tower.
But social media has made it possible, and technology, we're able to do this podcast, for example. Sure. I think it is changing the nature of how we communicate, and we're still learning how to navigate. The consequences of that, I think.
Yeah.
Some people have fallen afoul because of tweets, written in haste and regretted, and so on and so forth. But one criticism, David, that one could make of the AHA in this case, or activist academics more generally, if you will, is we pick and choose our fights. The critique that comes especially from the supporters of President Trump would be, yes, but on the left side of the spectrum. Mm. And so where were you? Where was the AHA statement about President Obama's use of drones, for example, in his foreign policy, or surveillance and domestic policy, all kinds of things? There was no AHA statement about those things. And so one potential criticism of this activity is you're concerned, but you're only concerned about certain things. And indeed, it reflects a left-wing agenda of the profession and the discipline. And this leads to a reaction such as the professor's watch
Watch
list,
list, sure.
so on, that we've seen in the emerge in the past month or so. Is that a problem in your view? Is
Well,
political, are we biased, or do we have to be upfront about our political biases, I suppose?
I think historians and academics, or at least academics in the humanities, we tend to be, actually, that's an understatement. We almost uniformly are on the left of center end of the spectrum.
Not always, but
Not
almost always.
always, but I mean, I think there was actually an article when I was at UNC where they checked the voter registration of every member of the history department, and out of 40 or 50 people, they found one Republican, and he was somebody who had been slightly marginalized within the department, and they hypothesized that was because of his political leanings, which may or may not be the case. I have no idea. So that we do have, I think, a we have fairly few, I think, ultra-conservative historians, at least within the mainstream academy. Obviously, there's people like David Barton and sort of alternate, right-wing historians, who are important within their own particular sort of sphere of influence. I don't think. I mean, there are multiple questions about sort of the venues, I think, in which we express these opinions. So I think all of us have, should have the freedom to express our political opinions outside of the classroom whenever we want to, whether that's engaging in a protest march, whether that's, writing letters to, our elected representatives, whether that's engaging in other kinds of political activity. I think we all have the right to do that. The tricky questions, come in is about how does this actually influence what we do in the classroom? I think oftentimes where we sort of open, leave ourselves open for attack is when we allow our political opinions, or political judgments, or call them whatever you want to intermesh themselves with, what we do in the classroom. And distinguishing those is, I think, easier for some people than others. I'm because of the kinds of things that I teach, my sort of political views often, even though I don't use the classroom as a vehicle for them, articulating my political views, they become, I think, clear in the kinds of topics I teach and the way that I teach them. And obviously here we're in a slightly different situation teaching British students rather than American students, and I think that the dynamic is different as a consequence. What's been
Oh,
your
yes. I
experience in
mean,
that regard?
yeah, we both, we're both specialists in the history of the United States, and we are citizens of the United States. And so, as citizens and as engaged citizens, and one would hope that all citizens are engaged, we can't help but bring our academic tea, such as it is, to bear
Frank, you're
versa.
breaking up a
Right
little
there.
bit. Can you repeat that last sentence?
What we teach. Yeah, I was sorry about that, David. I was saying that, we're both citizens and historians, and it's unsurprising that our views as citizens might affect the way we interpret the past and vice versa. And there is a kind of a potential tension in the classroom. And you're also correct that we happen to be working in an institution outside of the United States. I'd qualify your assessment, though, just slightly to say, while many of our students are British, probably most of our students are British,
Yeah.
our students are drawn from all over the world,
Oh, to
including
be
a
sure.
significant number of U.S. students. So we have quite a global audience, if you will, in our classrooms. We had a long discussion, as you know, when we started this podcast about whether to kind of officially affiliate with the University of Edinburgh, an institution I think we both enjoy working for and
Yes.
like and admire in many ways, or whether we should be independent. And at least for the time being, we took the decision that we should be independent. So although, so that we could speak freely and we would not be interpreted as speaking on behalf or for the University of Edinburgh. And that both protects, we see that as protecting us and protecting the University of Edinburgh when we express our views. So even that was a political decision. And this is the kind of things that, kind of thing, and these are the kind of questions that we as academics need to think about when we speak, whether it be in the classroom or more generally, such as on a podcast like this.
Yeah, I think that that's a fair point.
Yeah, and so I mean I completely agree with the AHA statement, but I recognize there's some validity to the criticism that the you know the this is a professional body that chooses to object to some things and not to others.
Yeah, to be sure, and I think this you know the Trump's election I think it has made lots of historians who are very hesitant about stepping out into public much more willing to do so. I something about the degree of change, the rapidity of change has, I think, awoken the activist in people who may have been, you know, griping on Facebook about various government activities, but are now, you know, I think willing or interested in speaking in a public way that is, I think, somewhat new.
That's right, and I think this will be it will be interesting to see how this unfolds, like in so many areas of American life and life more generally over the next few years.
All right, so it's time for our last drop, Frank. What do you got?
Right. Well, the reason I am in Washington is because I'm attending a Burns Supper, and Burns Suppers are a great Scottish tradition held to honor the birth of Robert Burns, the national poet of Scotland. That's not an official designation, but it's very much a fact. And Burns was born at the end of January. And so around the world, Scots and people with an interest in Scotland gather for Burns Suppers, in which they, well, it's there's a kind of formula one follows and there's a ritual one follows. There are poems in honor of, well, there are, sorry, sort of toasts and speeches in honor of Burns. Burns' poetry is read, notably his poem to the Haggis, Ode to the Haggis,
yes.
Which is the main item on the menu at a Burns Supper. Anyway, I'm here in Washington to attend a Burns Supper with our alumni group here, and it should be a great evening. And I'm reminded the dinner's going to be held at the Willard Hotel, which, as you know, is a grand old hotel in Washington. Its history is very interesting because it is claimed that it gave birth to modern lobbying. You might have something to say about that.
Yes.
But the Willard is interesting because in 1865, President Lincoln, in January of 1865, was contacted by the Washington Burns Club and invited to give the give a toast in honor of Burns, which is the kind of central event at a Burns Supper. And President Lincoln was a great admirer of Burns. He could recite Burns' poetry. Burns was one of his favorite poets. According to someone who studied law under Lincoln in the early 1840s, Lincoln, quote, had acquired the Scottish accent and could render Burns perfectly. I'm skeptical about that whenever I hear Americans try to speak with a Scottish accent. Lincoln's response is very interesting, and it's a kind of model for how to decline an invitation. So Lincoln declined this invitation to attend this Burns Supper, and he wrote, "I cannot frame a toast to Burns. I can say nothing worthy of his generous heart and transcending genius. Thinking what he has said, I cannot say anything which seems worth saying." That is about the most eloquent way to decline a speaking invitation that I've ever encountered. And Lincoln, who's one of the great prose stylists in American history and certainly in the history of the American presidency, basically said, "I can't write as well as Burns possibly do this. I have to speak tonight, although I'm not giving the immortal memory the central toast to Burns this year. But as I think about my remarks tonight, I'm thinking about Lincoln's remarks and thinking maybe I should have said that."
Now, do you like haggis?
I do, although on medical grounds, I can no longer have haggis.
Oh, that's very sad. I have tried each of the 4 years I've lived here to have a sort of mini Burns Supper at home. But invariably, my family doesn't like the haggis, so I have to make something else for them. But I subject them to at least a small bit of poetry and circumstance, which they tolerate.
Excellent. You've gone native. I do like whiskey and can have whiskey, and that's why we've titled the podcast
Because
this,
of
of course.
whiskey,
So
yes.
haggis is off the menu for me.
Menu.
Whiskey is on.
Not okay. Well, I heard that.
What's, oh, sorry.
So there had been, I think, a long time ban on importing Scottish haggis into the United States, which I saw in the news this week on one of the local Scottish newspapers that the UK and the US are in the process of negotiations to lift the ban on importing haggis. I think it was sort of ironic that they're lifting the ban on importing haggis at the same time they're putting a ban on refugees. I guess it shows something about priorities or something.
Well, it is indeed a special relationship.
All right,
What's
so
your last drop?
my, yeah, so for my last drop, yeah, I'm going to endorse an organization and a blog, a related blog. It's the African American Intellectual History Society and their blog. This is a relatively new organization founded by Chris Cameron, UNC Charlotte, really only, I think, 4 or 5 years ago. But in a very short time, they've developed a really robust, presence in, on their blog, talking about African American history, but especially about how African American history and current events and current culture and politics intertwine. And they've had a really great roster of people contribute to their blog, and they've started to get a conference together, and they've got a fellowship there. I think they've recently put together. So it's an organization and a blog I think people should check out, especially in honor of Black History Month. Great.
Excellent.
So for everyone who is listening, I'm hoping you're already subscribed to the show on iTunes or Stitcher, and if you're subscribed on iTunes, be sure to rate us and leave a comment. That helps people help find the show. It sort of raises the show up on the listings there on iTunes. If you want to check out our show page, or we'll have comments on all the things we talked about today, that's whiskeyrebellion.podbean.com. You can follow us on Twitter at whiskeyrebelpod. And you can also find us on Facebook. We've got a nice Facebook page, and we're going to start adding a bunch of stuff to that in the coming weeks. So come find us there as well. All right, until next week, the next drink's on us. Frank and I will be together next week, I guess, because
Yes,
you're heading
finally,
back.
I'll be back.
And we'll share some whiskey and talk some more history and current events and all kinds of things.
Excellent.